Welcome to the Possibility Project, an open conversation series where changemakers talk about the big questions we need to answer now. Your hosts are Devin Davey and Heather Hiscox, together with technical help from the nonprofit Snapcast. This series empowers the listener to shift systems, rebuild structures, and foster equity in the social impact sector.
So, welcome to Possibility Project. As you can see there on the opening slide, we are a growing community of disruptive changemakers reclaiming our power through meaningful sparks, actions, and connections. That's what we're here to do. So if, as I just mentioned, if you have missed any of our past episodes, this is our 21st episode, so we're well into season two. If you've missed them all, you can go to possibilityproject.org and check them out. Devin's going to be putting great info in the chat, so she'll put all the links that I'm referring to that you can click on and revisit later. If you want to subscribe to the YouTube channel, you can do that as well, and they will send you a little note every time we post a new recording in case you can't attend a certain event live, so please check those out. All of our posts are also shared on Nonprofit Snapcast, which is hosted by Mickey Desai. And Devin's also going to put a link for his other awesome podcast, which is called Inclusion Catalyst. So check that out. So we're going to use Zoom introduction guidelines that were provided to us by Nova Wren, who's an amazing previous guest twice for Possibility Project. He's from Genesis Healing Institute, and he has given everyone access to use those for any of their online gatherings and convenings. So I'm going to be referring to those and using those in my introduction. So my name is Heather Hiscox. I use she, her pronouns. I'm coming to you from the land that was kept and held sacred by the Tonohodom and the Pasquayaki people. I honor these ancestral keepers of this land where I am now living, and I honor their descendants who continue to breathe sacred life into our earth. And following the intro, we want to fully acknowledge that territory acknowledgements are just one small part of disrupting and dismantling colonial structures. And if you want to learn more about how this lightly touches the surface of privilege and power, you can check out the article that Devin is going to post. And if you type in, you can go to a website and look up where you live to see what land you occupy. And they can also text you that information. So we definitely encourage you to check that out. We also want to recognize that we and many of our guests often present a US-based perspective. And we welcome any other perspectives from other places and spaces. And for anyone who might be differently able visually, I'll just describe my appearance. I am a white woman with freckled skin and red hair. I'm wearing kind of a blue top with lots of pattern in a blue room and with colorful art behind me. And we are going to provide a detailed transcript via Otter of the entire episode that will also be provided within 48 hours with the full recording. So if that's more helpful for you to read, we will provide that as well. So my amazing co-creator is Devin Davey, and Devin is a strategy consultant helping female social entrepreneurs and networks by co-designing and implementing people and process solutions. You can learn more about Devin at her website. And I'm Heather Hiscox, the CEO and founder of Pause for Change. So I work with nonprofits, local governments, and philanthropic foundations to help them address problems and pursue opportunities in less time using fewer resources. So Devin and I started this project when COVID hit the US, and we had the dream of really trying to make this moment matter. We saw an opening in the sector for change. We saw people taking action that had been, you know, fought for decades, finally starting to bubble up, and we wanted to be part of this growing momentum. So we wanted to bring these into the light. We found that all these conversations previously were sort of in dark corners with our close networks, and we wanted to make sure that everyone had access to these conversations. So we brought them to this community, and we do everything for volunteer. Our speakers are amazing, and they volunteer their exquisite energy and time and brilliance. We donate our time as well. So if you appreciate this work, if you appreciate this episode, please make a gift at opencollective.com/possibilityproject. It's a really cool, open, transparent fiscal sponsorship organization. And this is these are the intentions or goals that we have for today, just to set some context for our chats. These are the goals of Possibility Project, of uniting a community of diverse change makers, stimulating new thinking, exploring collaboratively what's possible. There have been so many cool ripples that have happened from people meeting at these episodes and in this community and on LinkedIn. So please engage. And we want to start with ourselves. We know that's really where the transformation begins. So we encourage you all of you to go on that journey as well. So here's what we're going to do for the next time that we have together. We're finishing up our intros and we'll get to meet our amazing speakers. They are going to lead what we call our lightning talks, all about dysfunction related to our topic today. Then they're going to talk about hope and some examples and resources we can turn to. We're going to offer Q&A time for all of you. So please put comments in the chat. Please put any questions that pop up while they're speaking. And Devin will be going through that and pulling out those questions for the Q&A section. And then we like to add a little bit of extra time at the end. If you have to sign up at the 1 hour mark, we get it. But if you can stick around, you'll have a chance to process what you have learned, what you have heard from our speakers with a small group of other people that are also on this call today. So if you can stick around for that, we'd love to have you meet some others. And you'll get to meet people in just a second in a brief introduction. So the why was really, it was inspired by a person that's in my personal network, Josh Schachter, who runs an organization called Community Share, which is essentially a human library where people can go to make empathetic connections to others to help reinforce education. And Josh and I were talking about photography and story, and he really inspired this episode. So Devin's going to share some stuff in the chat. But some of the questions that we're asking are these that you see on the screen. You know, how often are stories used in an extractive way, or images in an extractive way? Like, who's the intended audience to see these images? What are we trying to evoke and why? And, you know, who gets to shape these narratives and how might that be problematic? So that's really what we're focused today for this topic. And so now we're going to get to our favorite part, is welcoming our guest. So we're a little bit different at Possibility Project, how we introduce ourselves, and we ask our guests to introduce themselves. Devin's going to put their super impressive bios into the chat, and I'll do just a basic intro, and they're just going to tell you a little story about themselves, something interesting. So I'm going to start with Ivelisse Morales. So Ivelisse is founder and CEO of Bombilla, a branding and design agency on a mission to spark change through creativity, collaboration, and community. So Ivelisse is going to tell us a story about her name. So take it away.
Thank you. Thank you, Heather. So a little bit of context. I identify as a third culture kid. My parents are from the beautiful island of Puerto Rico, or the Taino Arawak land of Borinquen. But I was born in Germany. My dad was in the U.S. military. And by the time I was in third grade, I had already lived on the island in Germany, in Washington State, Fort Lewis, and in Connecticut. And in third grade, my teacher, Mrs. Dixon, who was a white woman, decided that my name was too long. So she recommended I get a nickname. Mind you, at home, I don't have a nickname because Ivelisse is really easy to pronounce. And so she had suggested Lise, and the brand manager in me was like, no, I'd rather go by as Evie. So that's where Evie, the nickname, began. And I originally spelled it I-V-E. And then in eighth grade, I went through a personal rebrand and switched the spelling to I-V-I because I really thought that the palindrome looked really cool. And so when I moved out to the Bay Area in 2014, I really wanted to use that cross-country change and moment to start introducing myself first as Ivelisse, instead of just giving people the easy way out pronouncing and figuring out my name. And so the manager I had at the time, you know, I told her my name, you know, I go by Evie for short, and she was socializing me as Evie at my new job. So when I arrived and was introducing myself as Ivelisse, it created confusion. So I had to stand up at the staff meeting and explain to people that I'm Ivelisse. Evie and Ivelisse are the same people. That's that. And it was really fascinating to see that confusion. And on top of that, you know, for a long time, for most of my life, even my parents leaned towards anglicizing my name to make it easier. For example, at the doctor's appointment, for people to call out my name. A lot of people pronounce it Ivalice, Evalesi, Ivalice. And so Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who I actually went to school with at Boston University, she really inspired me to stop anglicizing my name and not to be ashamed of the syllables and the letters. And so ever since then, I've just been pronouncing my name the way it accurately is, the way my family and my friends were, you know, referred to me as. And so, yeah, just realizing like, wow, all this time I've been, you know, making myself small to make it easier for others, for English speakers and Americans.
I love that. Thank you so much for that story. It's so powerful. Oh, our next amazing, amazing guest is Tanya Anaisi. So Tanya is the founder and CEO of Betna Design. Betna Design is a design studio that applies the creative powers of design thinking to catalyze equity work. So Tanya is going to tell us a very interesting story about an experience she had while growing up in Arkansas.
Thanks, Heather. Hi, everybody. Good to see you. So my parents are immigrants from Lebanon. They left during the war. They landed first in Texas, but then raised us mostly in Arkansas. And in middle school, they sort of like put us in the stuff that our friends were doing because we wanted to be with our friends. So they put me in cotillion. Has anyone ever heard of cotillion? Okay, I see some nods. It is like a modern take on a debutante ball. So at that point, it was gender binaries. So it was what they called boys and girls. But you got to dress really cute, go out to dinner with your friends, and then like flirt with the gender you were interested in the whole night. So as a middle schooler, it was like, wow, this is the pinnacle of flirting opportunity. And so I really, really liked it. But it was like 99.9% of the folks were white. And there were some moments, like there was a 70s night. And my mom, in addition to being a talented doctor, is a talented seamstress. So she made me a head-to-toe custom outfit that was like a poodle skirt. But like, she didn't grow up here. Like, that's not the 70s in the US, but she didn't know. So I showed up and all these people were throwing shade. And I remember being angry. It's like one of the first times I was mad that people like didn't understand my family. And so I walked around in my poodle skirt like, ugh. People kept being like, that's not the 70s. And I was like, well, my mom made this. So what did your mom do? And I just remember being like, that's the first little sassy Tanya that came out. And besides the point, it's a longer story. I loved cotillion and I was named head girl the last year. And I was the only girl of color. And they like put me on stage and gave me a little crown. I remember being like, yes, this is what immigrants do. Anyway, I loved cotillion. If you ever want to talk about it, it was a hoot.
I love that. Those are such good stories. And they're both about like reclaiming who you are and be like, here I am. Here I am in my fullness. And we're all excited that I should be here, right? That's amazing. I think that's fabulous. Oh, I love it. So now that we've met, you know, Devin and I, our quick intros and our amazing speakers, we want you to meet one other person that's here today that's part of this community. So I'm going to send you really quickly. Do not panic. Your hair looks fine. You can even keep your video turned off. I'm going to send you quickly just for a couple minutes to meet another person. I'm going to open up the breakout rooms. And the prompt that we always use is please share something that made you smile today. If you don't have something, hopefully your partner will help you smile about something. So here we go. I'm going to open those up and we'll see in just a couple minutes. I'm just going to change the time because it will say like you get a half an hour, which is not the case. So here we go. Okay, everyone. Welcome back. If you're returning, we have 10 seconds for everyone else to come on back. So we're so glad you're back here with us. Let's see. All right. So welcome back. Welcome back. We hope that you had a lovely time meeting someone new. Some of you were lost, lonely souls by yourself. I tried to shoot you into rooms as quickly as I could, but sometimes Zoom is just hard to manage. So in the breakout rooms, if you can stick around that long, we'll try to make sure that you definitely have at least one or two other people that you can talk to. So thank you for your patience with that. Thanks for participating. You can definitely keep in touch with folks, meet them on LinkedIn, all the different things. So we love these connections. All right. So we are going to now go into the meat, the hearty bit of what we're here to do is to have this conversation. And if you're not familiar with Possibility Project, we always ask two questions. The first question is always, what dysfunctions do we want to disappear about the topic? And the second question is always, what's emerging that gives you hope
related to the topic, and that's about action, and that's about change and vision for what can be possible and new. So, but we want to hold space for what is messed up and how do we get here. So that's where we begin. So we are going to have our speakers kick us off. And Ivelisse, will you like to begin for us and talk about the dysfunctions we want to disappear?
Thank you. And thank you everyone for sharing your time with us today. It's truly an honor. I'm a little nervous. So long story short, the main dysfunction that needs to disappear is white supremacy in all of its forms. But to break it down a little bit, I think ultimately power structures. When I think about dysfunctions in the nonprofit space, I immediately think about the 501c3 tax status and model, which is patriarchal and paternalistic and really holds nonprofits back from investing in activities and thoughtful activities like marketing and being able to do them well and having the funds to actually pay people and create platforms to really center and uplift the folks that we're trying to help. To be honest, like I didn't know all of these big words like patriarchy or white supremacy until I moved to the Bay Area, but it doesn't mean that I didn't experience these things firsthand. Growing up in a household where the gender roles were really upheld by our Catholic culture, I fought against it. I rejected the kitchen and chores. It was a constant fight between me and my mom. And it's now as an adult where I realize like, oh, that's what we were really fighting, right? It wasn't necessarily like my mom and her expectations. It's like what we're actually sitting in. It's so insidious. And the fact that like anti-racism and these discussions are becoming more mainstream and not just sitting inside the social sector or within the DEI space, it's been really that also has been giving me hope. So that's a little kind of jumping ahead to that question. And so the other thing too, from a storytelling perspective that needs to change and disappear is the practice of tokenization. And so as a racially ambiguous Afro-Latina, Black Puerto Rican woman of color, I can't tell you how many times my story, my name and likeness have been used without my permission. There was one conference, for example, where of course you sign the media release when you attend an event, but then my face was plastered all over their marketing. And it's just like that, you know, I felt used because I know that they were just trying to promote the diversity that was at their conference. But as an attendant, I knew that that wasn't the case. When you're sitting in the seat and have the power of telling stories for an organization, making sure to ask for permission, be honest and transparent about how and where and why things will be used, and giving credit and paying people. On a side note, I also think that, or one thing I also want to acknowledge as well is that even as a person of color, you know, we all have our own power, privilege, and position. And as people of color, we can also replicate harm. I like Edgar Villanueva's way of framing it as off-white supremacy. And so, you know, I can only speak to my lived experiences. I can't represent everyone and everybody, but I can be a bridge. So really recognizing that, even as myself from where I'm coming from, I can also be harmful, and that requires humility, curiosity, and constant learning and unlearning, and really creating space for folks with less privilege and access than I have, and you know, passing the mic and sharing the access that I've been able to get through my education and my corporate career. A good example of this, for example, is if you're familiar with Lin-Manuel Miranda, who is the creator of Hamilton. He also just released a movie called In the Heights, which is a rendition of one of his Broadway shows. And he's been recently called out and called in for the gap in dark-skinned Afro-Latinos in his show, in his movie. And this movie is located in Washington Heights, which is a predominantly Black Caribbean community of Dominicans and Puerto Ricans, yet that's not what was visibly shown And even though he is from Washington Heights in that area of New York City, that, you know, it's like, it's even more shame on him, right? And so this is just an example that, like, this is, we all have a role and part to play. And particularly for those who are in this, here in this room, for example, who are exhibiting that curiosity, there's still a lot of work that we have to do, and ethics and equity that we have to uphold.
Thank you. Oh, that was great. And thanks for sharing your own experience. I think other people can definitely relate that are here today. Tanya, we want to hear from you. Say, share about the dysfunctions that you see.
Yes. Okay. Oh, it's going to be, it's easier to go second. I can build off Ibadi's points. Something I struggle with, we work with a lot of nonprofit partners through Baitna Design, and I'm seeing a couple things that keep coming up. One is like where the organization and the staff want to reimagine how they tell stories and how they fundraise in particular. Because a lot of times when it's tied to nonprofit, it's like the photos we use, the stories we tell are what allow us to raise money to do the work we want to do. And sometimes the staff gets stuck with like, this is paternalistic, this is condescending, this is not what we believe in, to show these pictures of folks like in grief, in living in conditions of poverty. Like that doesn't feel right. Our community is very resilient, and yet we need the money. And so they get stuck with like, our funders don't talk about it or think about it this way. They are giving the money to feel like they're helping people. And on an even deeper meta level, it's almost like, if I can give money to solve this, it almost reinforces that like, I am separate from those people, right? Like I will always be safe. I will not be like them because they need help and I can give help. So there's all these weird dynamics with funders. Like the intention is good, to redistribute wealth, to support people, right? But they get stuck there where the staff sometimes is like, we want to tell the narrative differently, but we may not get the money. So what choice do we make? Do we say like, we'll make this marketing choice to get the millions of dollars and then be like, okay, thanks, let's work with our people? Or do we say it's our job to educate funders and to find new funders that are mission aligned? So that's something that comes up a lot on this topic with partners I work with. But sometimes also the partner themselves, the staff, are still grappling with like, but it is our job to help. Like we're here to help. And these people are, you know, struggling for XYZ reason. I think what's tricky underneath that, to your point, Ibanez, around white supremacy, is there sort of an assumption that like these people have to be helped because they couldn't possibly do XYZ, or like not acknowledging their resilience, or rather just focusing on the conditions that they're experiencing as a way of saying like, that's, we have to help them because they can't do it themselves, or because, right, opposed to looking at the larger systems that created these conditions. I think it gets so boiled down to the most reductionist, tokenist thing, which is just like, oh, photo of a person of color looking distressed. You know what I mean? Or even like your, to your point, at least like smiling on the conference. My school was a segregation academy. We didn't know. My parents came as immigrants. That's a whole other story. But they treated us like shit. I mean, physical violence, emotional abuse, like horrible, horrible experience. And yet I was on every brochure. And it's just like, how? I told them off recently, they called me for fundraising. I was like, how dare you call me? She was really nice. She didn't know me. She hadn't worked there. Once I realized, it's a different story. I'm off topic. To my point earlier about the fundraising, I think I struggle too, because nonprofits also stuck in the scarcity competitive mode, which is like, we can't work together. We don't want to involve the community. We don't have time. We don't have money. Because I'll often help people do what we call co-design, which is like, instead, let's co-create the story together. Let's talk about what trade-offs we're willing to make, not for the community, but with them. Like they should be in the room. If we're going to make this trade-off to secure this funder that's not values aligned, like they should be able to have that conversation with us and weigh the pros and cons. But a lot of times the argument will be like, that'll take too long or that will cost too much. So they're all sort of interconnected. But I think the way nonprofits and funders are structured, the way that funders will say like, you have to do the project this way and check in with me every month. Like there's all these constraints in the system. Like, why do so many nonprofits even exist in America? The government should be responsible for a lot of these social benefits. Like, I could go on and on. But basically, I think we get cut within the system. We get caught in this trap of like, this is the quickest, easiest, fastest way to get money so we can run our nonprofit is like, let's, or even the corporate side, right? Like, there are all these ads after the murders of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery that were just like these like slow moving Black man voicing over this deep message. At the very end, it'd be like Coca-Cola. It's like, seriously? So anyway, I'll stop there. I think I'm going on and on, but I'm curious for others' thoughts.
No, I love it. And some of the things that we talked about when we were having our speaker chat, I thought was a really interesting point, is that some of these wealthy folks that are running these foundations are major donors. I can't remember which one of you said it, but some of their only interactions with Black and Brown folks are in terms of like landscaping services that come to their house and service workers, totally disconnected beyond your annual report and their landscaper or what the imagery that they see. And I wonder if you can speak a little more about that, like that disconnect. And we talked about kind of the white gaze, like who are we producing materials for? And can you go a little bit deeper into that?
Yeah. So for context, I was in a conversation with an old client who runs an education nonprofit in the Bay Area. And she was explaining to me quite honestly and candidly how her challenges and struggles in getting wealthy white folks to hand over their money. So there's a lot of politicking, you know, fancy brunches, nights out, golf trips. And, you know, it's a whole nother world that I'm not familiar with, but to hear her say that, you know, the stories of the children that we're supporting through our work, it doesn't resonate with them. And how do you crack that nut was really interesting to me. And there's actual research that shows that the wealthier a person is, the less empathetic and compassion they have. And there's even research that shows that folks of lower economic backgrounds are able to recognize facial expressions better than folks of higher economic statuses. So we're really coming up against a really big bias. And I think as communicators, storytellers, and nonprofit practitioners, really owning our role in dismantling and breaking through that bias. And of course, if you think about it as a bell curve, there's some people whose eyes and ears are more perked and primed and ready to have those tough, difficult conversations. And then there are people who are just in their world, in a bubble, and really treat philanthropy as charity and not as a way to spend down their wealth and share their privilege and power.
Yeah, Tanya, do you want to add anything to that?
I feel like I was just really resonating with everything that Ivette was saying, so I don't feel like I need to add more.
Great. Thank you. Totally align with what you're saying. So let's shift to the other part of the question. Ivette, you were joking that you kind of dropped a little dab of the next question, but now that we've talked about the dysfunction, and I think you've painted a really good picture of what's happening there, what's emerging that gives you hope? Like, what do you rely on in the way that you work and the people you work with and like what you're seeing that's emerging for a better future? Please leave us with some hopefulness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's been giving me hope is how much more mainstream anti-racism, co-creation and co-design are becoming. There's more sensitivity and respect, curiosity and celebration of it. And as communicators, really honing in on the fact that words matter, language matters, visual design matters. And so all of those pieces, like we need to have an extra thoughtfulness and intention. And some of that actually requires doing the personal work of realizing what your own gaps, what your own gaps are. It's also been really neat to see organizations relinquish control and actually, yes, doing the work that they should be doing, which is giving people money directly or passing over the mic directly and creating platforms for people to share their story without having to tone it down. One of my favorite examples of this is, I'm going to drop the link to it. In the Bay Area, there's an amazing Black-owned art gallery called Betty Ono, and they collaborated with Alliance for Girls and with 500 young high school women. They were able to create a campaign called Not One More Girl that was centered around stopping sexual harassment on public transportation. And the entire campaign was designed by them, right? So it's like, this is a public sector entity, BART, working, you know, they worked directly with a community-based organization that held the space and facilitated the design process with these young girls to create a campaign that impacts them directly and features them. And so when we think about storytelling,
Stories are how humans communicate since the dawn of time. And so it's powerful. As context, I'm traditionally trained in public relations, and I've always been really geeky about the power. It's an art and a science. It's the power, it's psychology, it's anthropology and social science, all intertwined with a little bit of design. And, you know, we've seen the harm that propaganda can make. So what does propaganda for good look like? We've seen how Trump's administration really used mainstream media to tell the wrong stories, and people believed him. So it works, y'all. And, you know, so it's like, how do we, you know, stories are able to change people's beliefs. Stories can create connections, build bridges. And it's like, as storytellers, how are we using this power for actual good? And so that's why, from a creative agency standpoint, we really do love working with policy changing organizations, because they're the ones on the ground who are actively using these strategies and tools to, you know, mobilize and rally people around a social issue and get that people power behind it, so that we can actually make systems change on all levels. And this is why also representation is so critical, because if we don't see ourselves in the stories, then we won't believe you. There won't be any trust. And on the flip side, I think that's where tokenization can go wrong, right? Because if you're using Black and brown faces to tell a false narrative, then you're lying and bringing people along, and that's not fair. Ironically enough, you know, over the last few years, the more advertisers have started using more models of different ethnic and racial identities, the more annoyed I get, because whereas before I could walk by ads that featured white people, for example, and just ignore it and walk by, now I'm being attracted by people who look like me, and now I'm giving more mental space to brands and ads and things that aren't relevant or helpful to me. So it's a conundrum for sure. It's like representation gone wrong on the extreme, I would say.
Oh, thank you for bringing those up. Oh, Tanya.
I would say a couple things that are giving me hope. One is that orgs that we're working with are having this conversation that I wasn't hearing a couple years ago. And it's almost like, let's say I'm talking to multiple clients in one day on Zoom, it'd be like all of them will bring it up. Like, how do we talk to the funder? They told us not to put, you know, not to talk about XYZ issue because it's not relevant, whatever. Like, it's just coming up a lot more, which gives me hope, because staff are then being like, well, what are we going to do about it? Let's talk about it. Let's change our strategy. So I feel like the conversation is happening, at least in the corners that I am hanging out in, which gives me a lot of hope. And then I would say there's someone named Mario Lugai, who is super, super rad, who I suggest checking out, who's a longtime organizer, has been in the design world, that's how we met, now is in the philanthropy giving world. And Mario talks a lot about political homes and how you used to have a political home, like when things were going wrong in society, you were stressed, emergency events were happening, like you had a place where you could go with people who are mission and values aligned, and you could like grieve together, take action together, whether that was a political party or a religious organization. Like, we had these homes in which we could be those parts of ourselves and show up, and those have largely deteriorated. And so now what it's become is like the only way to have a political home is to give, like give on a one-off campaign because you saw it on social media and it made you sad. And I think like so much giving has shifted that direction. And so the nonprofits are gathering around like collecting that capital because people want to do something. You know, when they hear about the murders, they want to do something. But he's saying at the cost of the deterioration of these political homes. And like, we're sort of untethered in our beliefs and in our actions because we're just giving in these one-off ways. So I think Mario has some really interesting thoughts about what does it mean to shift how we give, how we think about our role, what it looks like. He does many things. He founded Giving Side, which is a platform that sort of rethinks creating a political identity around how you give. And then also works at Justice Funders. They do some cool thinking about like the history and the future of philanthropy. So I love learning from Mario and people in his field who are thinking about like radically reshifting how we think about the components that, at least in my cons section, I think are like causing a lot of this tokenism and distrust and miscommunication. So that gives me hope. I'm also, two more things. One is I feel like there's, maybe it's just from where I'm sitting, but I'm seeing like an increased amount of race-based coalition building happening. It's like in American history, every 20 years, like the racial activist groups come together and then they get like infiltrated by the FBI or CIA and sort of get taken down from the inside. And then they regroup every 20 years. It's sort of like a pattern over the last couple hundred years. But just to see, like, my family is Lebanese, so Arab American groups supporting the movement for Black Lives, the movement for Black Lives standing up for Asian Americans who are suffering hate and violence, like to see them coming together and literally organizing strategically is something that gives me a lot of hope. Because I think growing up, we were in sort of that more distant period, and now folks are coming back together. So that gives me hope to think about, like, from the ground up, what communities are going to start saying about how stories are told and how they own them and how they run them. And also social media and the fact that a lot of stories, social media has a lot of ills, but I also think in some way people are reclaiming ownership. Like the first time I ever saw Arab American content that was relevant to me was in the last like 2 years because of Instagram and TikTok. I also deleted Instagram off my phone. So that's a larger conversation. But the fact that that exists and that if a community wants to tell a story that's different than a nonprofit, right? There's dissidents, there's conversation online, even if the relationships don't exist yet, which I find really interesting. And then the last thing I'll say is I really believe in co-design. I talk about it a lot. And basically what I mean by co-design is similar to what Ibalis was saying, was like you're working with the community or you're handing over and you're just facilitating. And they're telling the stories, they're owning, they're making the tough decisions, either with you or just supported by you. And I've cared about this work and wanted to do it for a long time. I've been asking partners for years. And just in the last year, there's been a massive spike in interest. Like once a month, folks are calling, like, we want to do a co-design project, we want to do a co-design project. And we did one with a group called the National Association for the Council of Children. It's a nonprofit that puts out, they do a lot of amazing work. One of the things they do is they put out a recommendation document for lawyers that support children in the welfare system about like what is best practice. And it's 10 years old. And they were like, we want to make a new version. But they came to me saying, we shouldn't dictate what it is. People who have lived experience in the system should. So they've relinquished a lot of power and brought in their youth advisory board, which are folks who are either currently or just exited the welfare system. And they heavily shaped the recommendations. They're also talking to lawyers, their board, et cetera, to get multiple stakeholder input. But they've been clear that like the input that matters the most is the people with lived experience. And they've designed those recommendations with them. They've even gotten into the writing together. So it's so cool to see that shift happening. And for a lot of partners, it's like, of course we should do it this way. And for some, it's still like, we really want to, but that's scary and hard. Like, but we want to talk about it. And then there's, of course, the folks that are just like, why would we? Like, we know best, et cetera. No, I don't think people would say that out loud, but there's this sort of assumption, right? That like, we know best. And there's this quote, it's attributed to Dr. Lila Watson, but she attributes it to a group of Aboriginal activists. I actually wrote it down. I want to get it wrong. But they say, if you have come to help me, you're wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is tied up with mine, then let us get to work. And I love thinking about like, what does it mean to work shoulder to shoulder, not to be helping people because they need us, but to be working together because we have shared interests in a cause. And because we truly feel that, you know, inequity and injustice here also makes us suffer, even if we're not directly experiencing it.
Oh, I love all that. There's such a strange assumption that there's no current problem solving going on in communities, that people are just like wander around waving their arms in the air, like, what should we do? Like, hello, people don't operate like that. We love shifting to action, right? People are already trying stuff. They're just stuck in a lot of these systems and structures, right? And so I love the co-design aspects that are really being elevated. Ibalis, you wanted to add to some of what Tanya was sharing.
Yeah. So, another thing that is really giving me hope is the rise of Black and Brown led creative agencies and studios like, you know, Bombilla and Baina Design, that are doing things differently and really giving these larger agencies a run for their money. As I like to, what comes to mind is like, anything you can do, we can do better. honestly, it took until last summer for the big agencies to finally get their racial reckoning. And so as they're fumbling over their own feet, trying to fix what's going on the inside, right? It's like, see you later, you know? I think the more there's a rise in consciousness that these larger, you know, more established, predominantly white dominant creative agencies that are creating content that we experience and engage with on a daily basis are actually causing harm, I think it's really putting smaller creative studios like ours in a position to do the work well and better, and from a place of humility, empathy, and cultural competence. And so I'm really excited about the work that you're all doing to, or the conversations that you're starting around the RFP process, because that is a hurdle in getting access to these larger contracts that have mass reach and mass impact, but are still, you know, more accessible to these organizations that don't have the leadership and the representation and equity and inclusion on the inside. So they do a lot of good branding on the outside, but we know, you know, when you look underneath the hood, that it's not the case. And so from a, you know, from my standpoint as a creative agency, small business, it's like, you know, the only way we can grow is for people believing in us and how we do things and really like working together to uplift everyone. Because as we grow, the more we're able to hire, right, and build wealth that we're and create jobs in the local communities that we're in. And we bring just the lens that these larger companies do not have. And you know, when you think about the RFP process and the power dynamics, a lot of times it just feels like, oh, you just want to check the box by having me as a sub vendor.
Absolutely. What Ivelisse is talking about is Devin, myself, and Nicole Markwick are writing an article about the extractive nature of RFPs and how they do harm because they're set up in this status quo system. So hopefully that will be released in the coming months. RFPs are the worst, she says in the chat. 100%. That's why I wrote the article, because we're like, I'm not doing it anymore. This is horrible. We hate it so much. So the other resource that I wanted to provide, there's a gentleman that presented at Spectrum 21 at SOCAP a couple weeks ago. His name is Tommy Johnson, and he's created a platform that's just getting off the ground. I just put it in the chat, called Made with Black Culture. And he wants to hold companies accountable for using these representation for their own revenue, their own wealth, you know, accumulation and wealth hoarding. And he wants to have, you know, entire products and service categories that have been vetted and have been like approved, right? Someone has made sure that people are reimbursed, people are compensated, people are recognized, that there's full understanding that what you took is not yours and you're benefiting from it. And he made a really beautiful point in his talk about, you know, the practice of taking, extracting, stealing, using without recognition has become normalized, and it's not normal. Those are abnormal behaviors that we teach children not to do, but in our culture and in work and capitalism and corporate and even in the social sector, we've adopted those behaviors without recognition of how abnormal and harmful they are. We've just thought this is the way you do it. So yeah, I really want to uplift his work, Tommy Johnson. I'll put his LinkedIn in there as well. So for questions, and it's a question that I wanted to ask too. Gloriella is asking, to your point, Ivelisse, what do you recommend as first steps that staff need to take in organizations, especially nonprofits, to do the internal self-reflection work? How can organizations support their staff in doing this? If you want to answer that, and Tanya, please jump in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question, Gloriella. And in full transparency, I'm not a DEI practitioner. I have fulfilled that role at companies I've worked at because usually I was the one and only, or, you know, the only or few staff members who really were pushing the leadership to invest and care about this. I remember at my first agency, there were only 4 folks of color out of a company out of 100, and being the bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, fresh college grad, I was like, we should build, you know, because My first job was in corporate social responsibility and cause marketing. And, you know, thinking about Black and Brown communities and how generous and giving and how obviously close we are to social issues that directly impact us, I saw an opportunity to really hone in on multicultural marketing. But I was like, you know, patted on the head. I even put like a pitch deck together. I had a lunch and learn breaking down the data I have found. And it wasn't until a competitor started dabbling in that work when the CEO started paying attention. So it ultimately came down to money, but the CEO and leadership weren't invested or interested. So it was only, even if they were gonna listen to me and do something, it wasn't going to be intentional and really coming from the heart. And I have also found, and this is why I didn't stay long in the nonprofit world, that sometimes fighting the fight within the nonprofit world is very, very like it's harmful and heartbreaking. And so we do have one client in full transparency who's actually working on this. This is their bread and butter. So they're ProInspire. They're an organization based on the East Coast, and they do DEI consulting and leadership training specifically for the social sector. And for the past few years, they've been working on this leadership model for race equity impact, which is basically a research and a framework. And what they've done is that they've realized that a lot of leadership and management frameworks are coming from a white male hetero perspective. So when we think about StrengthsFinder or MBTI or other frameworks that are used for professional development, they're missing intersectionality, they're missing sensitivity towards identities, don't have frameworks around equity and inclusion. And so that's what they're building in real time through a community of practice and through research. And their model actually starts with the window of self, which means to even start this work, we really have to start with ourselves. And that might not always be at work. And so if you are a staff member at a nonprofit, and you know, if you're not at a manager or executive leadership level, it's definitely going to be an uphill battle if it's not something that is a part of the values, model, and culture. But I wouldn't let that stop you from bringing that conversation up. And, you know, if it takes rallying other team members and approaching the leadership team with your concerns, I think that's a really great place to start, is having those conversations internally and, you know, flagging it to executive leadership. People at the top level are not in the day-to-day, and so it's so easy for them to just worry about being executive director or CEO and worry about the money, but they also need to be relinquishing that power structure and listening to their employees and being vulnerable and being honest about where they're at. So it kind of like goes bottom up, top down.
Absolutely. Tanya, you want to add to that?
Sure. It's similar. I love what you just landed on, like bottom. That's basically exactly what I was going to say. I've noticed, so I started Baitna Design to be an equity-centered and justice-centered design studio. And I thought people were going to hire us like instead of an IDEO or an Accenture, other design studios. What ended up happening is people started hiring us to do DEI work. So we do like org change and equity-based work, but we use liberatory design to say like, we're not going to tell you this is how to change your org or not. We're going to teach you how to make decisions in a liberation-rooted way. And you're together going to figure out what to do. And what I find what can be hard is sometimes leadership has a lot of fear. Like that's the way that white supremacy perpetuates itself. It makes it really scary and really taboo. And our history is so painful. We haven't reckoned with it, that it becomes so scary to open the door that sometimes leaders will be like, okay, we'll do equity work. And then stuff will come up and they're like, no, put it back in the box. Like we can't deal with that. Or like we said, we do equity work, but we're not willing to actually really consider any changes. So there's like this tense, it's almost like a really emotional support process where the leaders have to do some of their own reckoning around like, what does this mean? What are we okay with? Is it as scary as I think? What's the worst case scenario? What do we do if we create harm? There's like all this stuff that usually they just start taking action, because rightfully so, their staff are like, chop, chop. I want to see some changes happen. So leadership's like, okay, but they don't really reckon with any of that stuff either before or during. And so it ends up this like back and forth. Like, we're doing it. No, just kidding. You can't do that. Like, we'll do it over here. No. And it just creates all this turbulence, which can break a lot of trust with staff. And so what I suggest, it depends on the organization, but very similar to what you were saying, Evelise, is like the leadership needs a space to have some of that raw processing to understand what's really on the table, what they're willing to do and talk through their fears. And staff also need a space to say like, okay, what's our form of equity? Because they're going to have disagreements and different definitions as well. So I feel like starting in the work in a way that's safe to fail, meaning like if it fails, it won't cause emotional harm, mental harm, physical harm to those most impacted. It's like, are there small ways we can move forward to be taking action, but to also do it in a way that like we can grapple with all these complexities as they come? I think there's this idea that like we'll be faster and more efficient and there'll be less conflict if we just like keep it all bottled up. But that's actually like one, not really an option anymore because of the pressures that people are putting on companies, rightfully so. But also I would argue it's not an authentic, healthy culture. Like it's like that family dinner you go to where everyone's like, this is great. I love you so much. This is wonderful. And you know, they just had like a huge fight 10 minutes ago. Like I was thinking when I would go over to a friend's house, it's like, why can't we just talk about this? So yeah, that's my thoughts.
I love that. I love that. I want to uplift some of the comments in the chat. And Adriana, it's so funny. Adriana is saying that like she's nodding so much in appreciation and agreement, like her head hurts. So I'm so sorry that you're having a physical reaction to your alignment, but I feel you. I totally hear you. Some other pieces that came up when you were talking was one of our earlier episodes. This is a couple episodes ago. It was called Radical Allyship. And Fleur Larson, who is one of the guests on that episode, is a white woman that does DI work, you know, a lot centering around whiteness intentionally to help white folks do the work. She talks a lot about the work of especially older white women that needs to be done in the sector, because that's who is really holding a lot of these powerful positions in the sector. And that some of these white women have had to fight through sexism and patriarchy to get where they went. And intersectionality just was not part of the conversation in the women's movement, right? And so there's a legacy and a residue that's really impacting leadership today. And that's part of that fragility and that vulnerability that some leaders don't want to step into. So it's really interesting. I love Fleur's critique of that. And acknowledgement and recognition and trying to have an empathetic connection. And one of the things I love about that episode is our three speakers really come to the conversation of allyship based in love and curiosity and care for one another. There is anger. There is frustration, 100%. But I love how they root the conversation. So I definitely encourage you to check that out. And it's on the website. Christy Josbury was talking about the issue of unpaid internships and the not paying a living stipend and, you know, what that does in this sector, 100%. We just talked about that with talent justice in a recent episode as well, of like, how can people be paid? And then Gabrielle Rodriguez is talking about the younger generation of students creating spaces to share stories freely. And what we're seeing in the next generation of social change makers is awesome. Are there threads of that either of you want to comment on that you've noticed in the sector? And I'll look for some more questions as well.
Yeah, you know, I'm really, you know, even though I'm not that old, I feel old sometimes, but really inspired by, youth change makers. I'm realizing like it's time to change the baton. And I've been really thinking about how I can teach what I've learned and help them not make the same like mistakes, right? Like I'm very honest about the corporate world. I'm very honest about the pros and cons of attending a four-year university, you know, of going after skills-based programs where you actually learn marketable skills and can, you know, skip the debt, for example. And, you know, in the times that I've worked with you, some of my favorite moments have been giving them the mic, essentially. So there was one time where through the organization I was working at, we hosted an open mic where students were invited to share their talents and their stories in whatever shape or form that showed up in. We also hosted a film contest where we, you know, invited everyone to share their story in a 30-second clip. And it was super impressive on everything that they've developed. And we hosted a community watch party and gave away prizes and viewers' choice awards. And, you know, just to see them feel so proud of their own stories and where they're coming from and not having someone else tell their story so that they can get money. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. And, you know, we also, I'm just impressed at TikTok content creators. It's like, wow, I can't even figure out the app, let alone, you know, so yeah, it's like, how do we pave the way for them, knowing that like someone trailblazed the path for me. So how can I pave the road and fill the potholes for them? That's been really top of mind. Especially and also making them like helping them realize too that there are careers and there are a lot of amazing careers in social change and breaking out of the mold of like typical career options. So yeah, inviting more folks into the world of creative storytelling is like a passion of mine.
I love that. Tanya, do you want to add before we go to breakout rooms? No, okay. Yeah, I love that. And Tanya put it in the chat, like the someone blazed that trail for you and that you can pave that road and fill the potholes. I love that. I love that visual, right? I'm like, hold on, I got you. Just give me a minute. I'm going to get it all ready for you. I love that. It's great. Yeah, really great comments. We have time for one more question, actually, before we go to breakout. So let's see. So Jane is saying, thanks for a great discussion. As a design consultant in the social sector, I find that some of the most challenging dynamics related to power is in the beginning of projects. How do you manage the ways scoping and recruitment leads to the abuses of power by design teams and funders before the benefits of co-design can even be realized? That is a tremendous question. And I would also refer you, it's funny that we've touched on a lot of these topics in all of our other episodes that we've had, but George A. has an actual workshop, George A. from Greater Good Studio in Chicago. There's a 2-hour workshop, interactive workshop that you can watch. And he talks about how to root your decision-making in your values and how do you choose the right clients and how do you ask the right questions? So I'll refer you to that, but please, Tanya, do you have an answer? How would you talk about that, Jane? That's a great question.
Yeah. Just yeah to that. I feel that so much. I would say part of the pro of being an outside studio and a consultant is when we come in, a lot of our clients that we choose to work with, again, we're picky based on if their values aligned, are very open to saying like, help us think about this. So what's shifted for me is I've had the courage to build it into proposals to say like, there's this whole pre-phase and like, I'll call them workshops where I work with them to be like, what are your values? What are out of bounds? How are you willing to share power? Why or why not? So we do all this stuff before we even, I call it designing the invitation, before we even reach out to a co-designer to start recruitment. And I haven't been getting pushback on it. So far so good. Finding the right partners, just naming that, like, of course that's so important. And then when thinking about recruiting, we're going through, we do offer financial incentives. So I'm going to ask a question about like living wage. I use this calculator. Oh no, didn't get you the link. Hold on. It's called the MIT Living Wage Calculator. Maybe y'all have seen it. I use this as the floor to talk about like minimum that we're going to compensate people. But we do pay people for their collaboration because in my mind, like they're a consultant. They're also a consultant. Like we can't do the project without them. It's kind of absurd that we extract information from them without paying them, which is the norm in the design world. It's like people like being heard from. It's like, no, they're working 3 jobs and have lives and like they deserve to be paid. I'm being paid for this. Why are they not being paid? Anyway, you get my point. So we try to work with organizations that have trusted relationships with folks. We might say like, is there someone that you hear from a lot who might be excited about the project? Are there people you don't hear from a lot? How could we reach them? And actually with a partner, the Columbus Foundation in Ohio, we've been running co-design projects completely on Zoom. Like some people don't have access to internet. We call them on the phone. One person couldn't get on the Zoom phone line. So I called them on my phone and put them on the speaker on the Zoom. Like there are ways to make it work. You can mail people worksheets they send back to you. Like when folks say, there's not a way. I think what I've done with clients is taken a little more burden of leading that and facilitating that. Cause I think that's my role, not to choose and make decisions, but actually to hold the process. And then once you show them, they're like, oh, that was a little easier than I thought. And I also have like a toolkit that we built that helps people work through it. But I think the facilitation is so helpful. So I would say I facilitate heavier in the beginning, to your point, because all this stuff is like so risky. And, you know, when co-designers show up, there's so much trust that has to be built. Oh my gosh, I could say all these things, or you could just read this book called Beyond Sticky Notes by Kellyanne McCurcher. And they have done a beautiful job talking about how to build relationships, how long it takes, what's needed for a great co-design project. I have like 1,000 tabs in it.
I love that. I love that. Iblis, is there anything burning that you want to share before we actually go to breakout rooms?
No, I just, to Tanya, yes, to everything that was shared. I think sharing these examples of tangible ways to power share are super, super helpful. And one thing I'm selfishly curious about is how other people on the line in this Zoom room are exploring that in their own organizations, because I think it's so important to like learn from one another and like amplify and uplift what is working on the ground.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we talked about in the moments before we went live and we started the conversation was hearing from all of you, kind of crowdsourcing from the design community and also all of you, what are you doing that you are working in co-design or, you know, beautifully curated and co-created documents or like, you know, paraphernalia and like brochures and websites and things that you're doing that are created with community voice. We would love to see and hear examples. So we'll make sure in the email that we send to you in about 48 hours with a recording and all of the resources, we'll put a prompt there just to remind you to start sharing websites. We'll keep adding those to the resources on our website and we'll share them with all the attendees and registrants from this episode as well. And we'll keep adding to that. I think that's a great idea. So what we're going to do is go to breakout rooms, and some of our friends have had to jump off, which is totally fine. We get it. They have to do other meetings. But with all of you that are here, we want to talk about just some community care considerations to make before we go to breakout rooms. We want it to be a safe space to share. If you want to take anything of inspiration, do not leave a person's name attached to it. They are sharing in a space with the assumption that it's confidential what they're sharing. So if you want to share something in the chat or even beyond this space, know that no names or attribution are to be attached to that. So I want to merely say that. If you normally take up the time, step back. If you usually step back, step in a bit. The facilitator, we like to have one of you in charge just to keep everybody on track and make sure you're holding space for each person in the group to have some talking time. So the facilitator is the person who lives closest to a body of water. Every time we just make up a different prompt. So that's one that Devin came up with, I think is fun. So whoever lives closest to the largest body of water, in case you live in a very watery area, whoever's largest. And then what you're sharing is just what's sticking with you so far. You know, what's top of mind? What are you thinking about? What's something you want to engage in conversation about? So I will do the same practice. Well, I will move people around. So give me a moment. You'll have about 12 minutes to chat, and our speakers will just give us a little tie-in summary and we'll talk about our next episode. So I'm going to open the rooms now and I'll give you about a minute to wrap up and I'll move people around. So give me some space. We'll see you in a little bit. So what we want to do is have each of our speakers just take a couple minutes, 1-2 minutes, just saying, you know, what's alive for you, like kind of tying all of it together, all of the conversations that we've had between the two of you and in our community and in your group. Take it away. Who wants to go first? Okay, Tanya.
Thanks. I'm always waiting. I'm like, Ivalis is going to take this, right? what's bubbling up? I think I'm feeling a lot of hope and energy from the breakout room and that so many people care about this conversation, that they'll take time out of their work day when we're so tired of Zoom. I don't know. I'm just feeling a lot of hope right now. I think the dream is like two things are happening. My group talked about this a little bit. Like this new way of working is so authentic, is so love-based, is so liberating for all of us that it becomes like irresistible. Like people do a co-design project. They're like, how could I ever not do, you know, like do it the old way again. That's part of the dream. And then for the folks on the other side of the spectrum who are not interested or are like actively constraining and resisting, it's like, what's the pressure being put on them so that they become obsolete if they don't operate this way? I think it's more long-term if it's rooted in like the love and then walking over here, but also like we have to acknowledge that some people are not, because of trauma, are not ever going to come along. So then like, what do we have to do? I think that's where I'm landed. Or like, what's the spectrum of interventions, which is why it's so cool that so many of us are here. Like, we need to do it, each of us, in different ways, because we're going to find our niche of who we can impact and what our legacies will be. That's how I'm feeling.
I love that. I love that. And it's such an opportunity for empathy, right? Love is rooted and connected to empathy. So meeting people where they are and understanding why they can't see what we can see, right? And trying to share those stories, I think, is so powerful. Ivelisse, what would you say?
Yeah, you know, in our group, there was a lot of gratitude and appetite for problem solving and actually figuring this out. And so to Tanya's point, we need players in all positions. And I know for a lot of us who've been inside government, social sector, or corporate companies, we escape to become consultants. But it's like, we also need people on the inside. So, you know, I think we can hop between both, but realizing like we need different roles and different positions working in tandem to go towards true systems change. And one thing that we specifically talked about was the pace of our work. So there's certainly urgency in the social and environmental issues and crises that are impacting our everyday. But as humans who are trying to do this work collaboratively, we can't rush the process. And one great quote that Kyla shared with us, and we'll have to find who to attribute to, is moving at the speed of trust. And so as graphic designers, we certainly feel that pinch when clients have, you know, deadlines that are unrealistic and inhumane to the creative process. And we always ask, is this a real deadline? Are we creating fake stress? Does this allow spaciousness for dialogue, consensus building, alignment? Are we, you know, do we have the right folks and stakeholders in the room from beginning to end? And the times that we have taken and risked timeline and speed, we end up finding that it takes either as long as we originally thought or longer, especially when we want to do things thoughtfully and well. So that capitalist culture that has seeped into the social sector from the business world, maybe a little bit of time optimism and like the negative impact of technology and how quickly everything is at our fingertips, and realizing like humans don't work at that pace, or nature at that fact.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's so important to recognize those characteristics of grounding our teams in this shared liberation and, you know, in those white supremacist practices around urgency and, you know, the spoken word is more highly prized than all others, and all these different characteristics are so important. So we always share Tem Okun's work pretty much every episode, so we'll put that in there as well. Thank you both so much, Ivelisse and Tanya. It's been so much fun hearing from you. And I know our community has absolutely loved it. And we're just so pleased to be connected and invite you to be a part of this. And thank you to all of you that are here. We'll send an email with that full summary, all the resources, the transcript, the video, everything. And we'll talk to you about our next episode, which is on July 19th. And it's focused on unrecognized philanthropy in the Black community. This complete myth, an erroneous narrative that the Black community are not philanthropists, that are not givers, that are not providing amazing wealth and power and ability and gifts that they bring. And so we're definitely going to talk to some leaders that have studied this and work in giving circles and have done some amazing data analysis and all of that. So we hope that you'll join us on July 19th at 11 a.m. And Devin put the registration there. So we'll put a little image for that and the registration link in the follow-up. And Devin put the opencollective.com. If you can make any gift of any size to support this work, we would absolutely love it. And join the LinkedIn group. There were 11 of you that had asked to join, so I already approved all of those. So come join the party if you haven't already. And thank you so, so much to our speakers again, Tanya and Ivelisse, and to all of you that have joined. And we can't wait to see you in the future. Take good care. Be well.
Hi, everyone. Have a great day.
Much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Please do join us for the next Live Possibility Project so you can take part in the breakout sessions that follow. All sessions are recorded. Please visit possibilityproject.org and connect with us on LinkedIn so we can invite you to meet more incredible impact influencers and make new connections with people who care about what you care about. This has been Possibility Project, produced in cooperation with the nonprofit Snapcast.